Interestingly enough, and appropriate for the day of this this shiur, the title of the shiur is like sheep to slaughter. Now you've heard probably many times the accusation or the comment that our people went to their deaths in the Holocaust like sheep to the slaughter. Have you heard that?
Yeah.
And it's said not in a complimentary way. That they shouldn't have done that. They should have put up a fight. And the Warsaw Ghetto is given as an example of an event where they did put up a fight. And that has become the epitome of Jewish heroism. The Warsaw Ghetto, rather than those who went to their slaughter like sheep. Tonight's shiur, dedicated to the memory of the martyrs who did go to the slaughter like sheep, is going to explain why, from a Torah perspective, I believe they did the right thing. Not that it was like, you'll see, they didn't go like sheep to the slaughter. They did something you've never seen a sheep do. Sheep fight. If they know their life is in danger, they fight. So fighting for your survival is not the highest form of human evolution. That every animal can do. What the 6 million martyrs did, most of them, no other being can do. And we'll understand a little bit more about that and why it was so critically important. In so doing, we're going to use the opening of the parasha. And remember, Philip, I think you commented when we started the shiur, what are you going to do when you get to these parshas? How can you make something interesting and relevant out of all of this? Remember that comment? So I thought that was a good challenge. And in fact, Chief Rabbi Sachs told me that when Tony Blair used to learn Chumash and used to call him to discuss it from time to time, and called him once to say he's in a real boring part. He was in Vayakel, Pekuda, in all those areas, and he was finding the Old Testament very boring. And Chief Rabbi Sachs said to him, "You think that's boring? Wait till you get to Tazria Metzora and these areas. Then you'll get the real boring stuff." So let's see what we can make out of the boring stuff. When you've got a boring parasha, the challenge for a speaker, for a teacher, is you can't just open up and say, "Well, let's talk about this theme or this story." Or there are no stories. There are no real themes. There's a lot of halacha. Most of the halacha, most of the laws don't apply today directly. So when that happens, I just tend to start at the beginning of the parasha. And as you'll see from today, I don't get further than the first or the second pasuk, and it's already completely relevant. Hi, come inside. You haven't missed anything yet. So take a seat and make yourselves comfortable. So you'll see as we move into it, what we're able to learn from the parasha, we're going to learn a uniquely Jewish perspective on sanctity and life. Something that is so unique to the Torah. Just from the first few sentences of the parasha. In fact, we have to start at the end of yesterday's parasha. So if you look at the end of yesterday's parasha, the parasha builds up to quite a crescendo of sanctity. If you look at chapter 11, verse 44, Yud Aleph Mem Dalet. So after all the laws of the kosher animals and the treif animals and what we can eat and what we can't eat, the Torah tells us, Ki ani Hashem Elokechem, for I am your God, v'hiskadashtem, and you have to take steps to sanctify yourselves. V'hiskadashtem is a tzivui, it's a commandment. It's not a statement of fact. You must make yourselves holy. Now, that's quite interesting. You know, the people question a lot what it is that they do and whether they do things meticulously enough. Do we eat the right meat? Do we keep Shabbos well enough? Do we keep Taras HaMishpocha well enough? All of these are crucially important questions. But do we ever stop to ask ourselves, in what way have I been mekayim that mitzvah today? In what way was I mekayim? In what way did I fulfill the commandment of v'hiskadashtem? You shall make yourselves holy. V'hiskadishtem v'hiyisim kadoshim, and then you will be holy. And Chazal say that that means that we can't do it all. You can't just become holy, but you can take steps towards holiness. And then there's siyata dishmaya, Hashem helps. We take the steps towards holiness, and we'll discuss today a little bit about what holiness means. Then you will be holy. This is the mission of the Jewish people more than anything else. Our mission is not to win Nobel Prizes. Our mission is not to beat the daylights out of our Arab enemies. Our mission is v'hiskadishtem, to be a holy nation. That's our mission. We don't have another mission. That's what we were created for. To be holy, to parallel God, and to emulate God as far as we can, so as to bring His presence and His energy into the world. We are the channel through which God's energy is brought into the world. That's our job. We don't have another job. We have ways of earning a living, and we have various other things that we can do, but we don't have another job. We don't have another mission. That is our mission. V'hiskadishtem v'hiyisim kadoshim ki kadosh ani, because I am holy. And then in 45 again, ki ani Hashem amaleschem eretz Mitzrayim, because that's why I took you out of Egypt. I didn't take you out of Egypt to give you Israel. I didn't even take you out of Egypt to give you the Torah. I took you out of Egypt so that you would become a holy nation. To do that, you have to get the Torah. To do that, you need Israel. But those aren't your missions. Your mission is v'hiskadishtem. And that's what we've got to ask ourselves constantly. And that's what we should be asking our children. What have you done today for v'hiskadishtem? In what way have you been a kiddush Hashem today? In what way have you sanctified yourself and sanctified your environment? How have you done that? It's quite interesting. Sometimes I just open a book, a sefer, and I see where it opens and I gain insight from it. And once I was sitting in a plane and I was feeling contaminated. I don't even remember what the cause of it was, whether it was conversation that was taking place or next to me or behind me or just the kind of people on the plane or the drinking that was going on. I don't even remember what it was, but I remember the feeling of feeling contaminated. So I opened on my iPhone, I've got a whole lot of Sforim, one of the first ones I picked is a little sefer written by one of the early Lubavitcher Rebbes, which is like a daily little diary of insights. And phones, I better check mine too. And one of them there was that, it was quite amazing, these things are very miraculous when these things happen. The comment was, when you're sitting in an environment, you breathe in that environment. Now, there was just an article written this last week about how the carbon dioxide, the breath you breathe out, is one of the most accurate forms of identification, because no two people breathe out the same breath. So if you analyze people's breath, you can actually establish identification like you can with a fingerprint. So a whole lot of stuff that they've just done now. So you're sitting in a closed environment and people are breathing out. Right in the beginning of the Torah, when we're told that God breathed the breath of life into Adam, what are we told? He breathed man de nafach mitocho nafach. That he, when one breathes, you breathe from inside you. So that was a way of giving Adam sanctity. God breathed sanctity from inside him. Now what happens if the people that are breathing on you don't have sanctity? What are they breathing on you? So you're contaminated by that. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, and so what do you do about that? And he said, you can actually cleanse the air. You can actually filter the air. And you do it through learning Torah and putting out a different energy. And it cancels out the negative force of all this energy that's going around this closed environment in which you find yourself. So v'hiskadishtem, we're meant to bring God's energy into the world and to do it in the way that we live, in the way that we operate, in the way that we think, in the way that we speak, in everything that we do. And that's why I took you out of Egypt. V'hiyisim kadoshim, and once again, and you shall be holy. How many times does he tell us that? You shall be holy. Ki kadosh oni, because I am holy. And if you want to connect with me, the only way you can connect with me, says God, is to be holy in the way I am. Of course, we can't be as holy as God, But we've got to be holy in the ways that God is holy. V'halachta bidrachov, we've got to emulate God so that we can be on His wavelength. If we're not on His wavelength, there can't be a connection. And the way we get onto the wavelength is through the method of Kedusha. That's what Kedusha is. Kedusha is a divine wavelength. And the Jewish people have been given the means, the skills, the instruments, and the soul with which to reach that resonance, that wavelength, that is able to pick up God's wavelength and connect with God in that way. And when we're connected with God, you feel it, you know it. You know it. Things go in a different way. Things happen in a different way. You feel differently. When you're connected with God, you know it. And that's one of the mitzvahs that we have. That's a chiyuv. So that's how last week's Sedra ends. What does the next Sedra start with? What would you think if you were writing the Torah and you'd built this whole thing up? You must be holy because I'm holy. What do you think the next thing would be about? Studying Torah, prayer, sacrifice. The next thing is not even bris. The next thing is sexuality. That's what Tazria opens with. Now tonight's shiur is a little sensitive, but I decided I would share these ideas with you because Torah v'lilmud anu tzrichim. This is part of Torah and we have to learn it. Because the understandings, the insights and the applications are so significant. That the fact that it's sensitive, we just have to treat it in a sensitive way and understand it in a sensitive way. But right after Kiddushin, and it's so interesting because what is marriage called? Kiddushin. No other culture in the world does that. Everybody else regards marriage as kind of a concession to human weakness or a necessity for procreation. But to see Avodas Hashem, not just in marriage, but in the intimate connection between man and woman, between husband and wife, that's uniquely Jewish. That's uniquely Torah. So just as Kiddushin, you have Kedusha in marriage, when man and woman come together, that's an act of Kedusha. So when God has just said, V'hiskadishtem, you shall be holy, you shall have sanctity, the next thing He says is Isho ki tazria. Now we'll figure out how to translate Isha ki tazria. There are many levels of translation of that word, and we're going to discuss several of them. But very simply, a woman conceives. So we're talking about the moment of conception. That's what tazria is about. When a woman conceives life, that's the moment. And that's the first thing we're taught after V'hiskadishtim. You want to know how to be holy? Men and women relationships. What does that mean? And the Baal HaTurim talks about this connection, that V'hiskadishtem comes right before Isho ki tazria, in order, he says, to teach she'tzarich lekadesh atzmo b'sha'as tashmish. Because when man and woman are having relations, there has to be kedusha. Now we'll figure out, what does that mean? What kind of kedusha? How can there be kedusha? What's the kedusha? And to understand that, I'm going to have to give you a few minutes of introduction to a side. We'll have to take a little detour, and then we'll come back to it. The detour is an understanding how human beings, or any being, finds security. Now, we don't have time to go into a long conversation about this now. We can do that at another time. But I strongly believe that insecurity is one of the biggest gifts of God, and we all have it all the time. Everybody is insecure always. And insecurity drives everything we do. It drives us to make money, it drives us to build businesses, it drives us to get married, it drives our love, it drives our battles, it drives the terrible things we do, and it drives the wonderful things we do, to try and overcome that feeling of insecurity. But there are two different ways to overcome insecurity. The one is the constellation of emotions and activities that I categorize under the section of fear. And fear are all the things we do to affirm ourselves, to feel alive, to feel secure in a physical way. And we do all sorts of things. We do sometimes crazy things to make ourselves feel alive because we feel that insecurity. By insecurity, I don't mean necessarily financial insecurity or physical health insecurity or emotional insecurity. It's everything together. Sometimes it's a deeply existential insecurity. And when we feel insecure, sometimes we're not even aware of it. But addiction is a form of dealing with insecurity. And we all have all sorts of addictions. When we become dependent on an external source to make ourselves feel alive, all we have to do is take a walk through any of our homes and see how many tzatzkas we've accumulated that serve no function whatever. But at the time we bought them, they made us feel good. And then they get stored somewhere and they start cluttering the place and eventually you get rid of them. And you figure out how much of that, why did we do it? Why did we get the stuff? We get stuff, we accumulate, that's part of the way we deal with insecurity. And many other things we do because of insecurity, and great things we do also. One of the ways we overcome insecurity is through love. And love is where you're able to lose yourself in someone, or someone other than you, or something bigger than you, to use Viktor Frankl's words. The human being feels his best and feels his most satisfied and his happiest when he's dedicating himself or herself to something bigger than him or her, or to someone other than him or her. When you lose yourself in a cause, you don't feel insecure. When you lose yourself in love of another human being, you don't feel insecure. When you hold on to your own ego and your own self, even in that relationship, then you feel insecure. And then you do all the ego stuff. And that's when relationships break down, because relationships can't exist when they're driven by ego and insecurity. And we see this in Chazal, in two Mishnahs in Pirkei Avos. The one is, and you know them both, I'm sure, the one is Hakino v'hakovod v'hatavo, Mutsiin es ha'adam min ha'ilam. Jealousy, honor, and lust cause people to exit from the world. They have no existence. They're disconnected from the world. That's the insecurity. Because in those three drives, three very powerful ego drives, jealousy, I want what somebody else has got. Honor, I want you to give me honor. Taiva, I want to feel satisfaction from something outside of myself. I want to eat something, or I want to experience something, or I want to possess something, or I want to have a physical relationship with somebody in order to satisfy a craving. So the satisfaction of a craving means I can't do it myself. I need something or someone outside of myself. That's what kina covered in taiva is. And it's mutsinis adam in olam. That takes us out of life. It doesn't kill us. We carry on living, but we're out of the world. We're not attached to the world. We're not centered in the world. We're not aligned with the world. We're out of the world. In English, when we say it's out of this world, we mean that in a good sense. And the Torah says you're out of this world. That's not a compliment. You're out of this world. That's trouble. So mutsiin es adam min ha'olam, that's when you're out of this world in a negative sense. Those are the ego drives. Kinah, kovod, taiva. I need external forces or objects or people to satisfy me. Without them, I cannot be satisfied. And then on the other hand, we have al shlosho dvorim ha'ilam oimei. That world out of which kinah, kovod, and taiva drives you, that world stands on three pillars. That same oilam. Al ha'toro, al ha'avoido, val gemilus chasodim. Because a Jew can lose himself in three areas, in three domains. We can lose ourselves intellectually, and we can lose ourselves spiritually, and we can lose ourselves emotionally. A Jew can become so involved in an idea that his own existence is subservient to the idea. And that, more than anything else, is the reason for Jewish accomplishment. It's not because we're brighter than other people. That's been disproved. We're not any brighter than some of the other bright nations in the world. That's not why we've won a lot of Nobel Prizes. That's not why we've led a lot of revolutionary changes in different parts of the world, in different arenas and areas of human life. The reason is because when we get involved with an idea, we are completely subservient to the idea. In Torah language, we are mevatel ourselves. We nullify our egos and put ourselves entirely into the idea. We do that with our businesses. When Jews are good businessmen, you'll hear people say, it's not because they're good businessmen. It's because they know how to put themselves into something bigger than them and dedicate themselves to it, that this is their life. This is really important. Not because of the money it makes. They do it even when they're very wealthy. It's just the way we are. That when an idea makes sense to us, we put our all into it. That's what we do. So we can do it intellectually. We're built that way because we're meant to do that in Torah. When a Jew studies the Torah the proper way, he completely forgets himself. Which is one of the reasons that men have to do all the mitzvahs, shazman, groma, all the time-related mitzvahs, because if they didn't have to do them, they wouldn't know what time of the day or night it was. They would be so completely, we abstract ourselves. We can abstract ourselves. That's really what we do. We become abstract. Not only do we study abstract. You see, a concrete being can't study abstract. It's not possible. The only way you can really study abstract is to become abstract. And a Jew can become abstract. When a Jew discusses a philosophic idea, it's not a concrete mind studying an abstract idea. It's an abstract mind. It's my neshome. When a Jew is dealing with an idea in the Torah, or in mathematics, or in philosophy, or in politics, or wherever it is, or in business, he's dealing with it as an idea. He abstracts himself. It's called in Kabbalah. It's called hispashtus hagashmius. We actually strip ourselves of our concrete form, and we actually elevate ourselves. You know that image of Eliyahu going up in fire. So theoretically, that's what the great people, the great Jewish lights have been able to do. Have actually been able to extricate themselves from their concrete being and to abstract themselves. And to engage in abstraction as an abstract. That's what we can do. And we can do it in our avodah. We can do it in our mitzvahs. That when we're doing a mitzvah, we can lose ourselves completely. Lose our ego, lose our sense of self, lose our pride, lose our arrogance, and become completely involved and engaged in the mitzvah. That nothing else exists when that's happening. That's what a Jew can do. We can do it in our avodah. And we can do it in gemilus chasodim. We can do it in socially with people. We can lose ourselves in the needs of others. We can lose ourselves in serving others. These were three things at which we excel. Other people have them too. It's not as if we're the only people who have them, but we have them in big doses. This is natural for us to do. It's natural for us to lose ourselves in Torah, in Avodah, or in gemilus chasodim. We're not naturally good at doing what the Asians can do, or claim to be able to do, to lose their ego sitting in silent meditation. That's not our thing. That might be an Asian thing. We don't lose our ego in silent meditation. We lose our ego in Torah, Avodah, and Gemilus Chasodim. That's where we meditate. We meditate while we're learning. We meditate while we're shaking our lulav or putting on our tefillin. That's when we lose ourselves, when we move into another world and abstract ourselves. And we meditate when we're doing chesed. We meditate when we're engaged and involved with another human being. So now let's come to the act of intimacy between man and woman. Is that an act of ego? Or is that an act of selflessness? Is that an act of ta'ava? Is that lust and passion? Or is that avodah? Is that service of God? And of course the answer is it's both. And therefore that act, the act of intimacy between a man and a woman, is the prototype of all actions. Every action is modeled by the action, and you'll see why, by the action of the relationship, the intimate relationship between a man and a woman. Let's have a look and see why. So the intimate act between man and woman is the initiation of life. Let's start looking at our pasuk again at the beginning of Parshas Tazria. Daber el bnei Yisrael lemar, tell the Jewish people, saying, Ishor ki Tazria. This is a very difficult verse. It's difficult to understand what it means. The phrasing is difficult. The concepts are difficult. It's an extremely difficult verse. But let's, and you can't kind of understand it all at once. You've got to take it at different layers, and then you put the layers together and you see it all. So on the simple level, Isha ki Tazria, a woman conceives. And if a woman conceives, Isha ki Tazria, or a woman, when she conceives, Veyolda Zachor, and gives birth to a male, then there are a lot of laws. Then it gets easy. Then for 7 days she's Tameo, she has the same laws as a Nidor, husband and wife can't have relations, can't be intimate. The 8th day is the Bris, and that's a very beautiful idea. One of the reasons that is given for the Bris being on the 8th day is so that it wouldn't be appropriate for everybody to be partying and the husband and wife can't be intimate. It just doesn't feel right. So wait for the Bris, wait till they can be intimate. Just a sensitivity to the importance that what created the celebration of the Bris, what you're celebrating is the creation of life. What created life? The intimacy of the husband and wife. And right now, the husband and wife can't be intimate. That's not nice. That's not good. So wait until the 8th day. That's one of the reasons it's given, so that everybody can celebrate on the 8th day. And then for another 33 days, they can be together, the husband and wife can be together, but she can't be involved in any kind of temple activity. And if she has a female child, if she has a daughter, then it's 14 days and another 66 days. It's double the time both on both sides. And then there's a sacrifice to be brought and all of that. Then there are a whole lot of laws that are triggered by the birth. But that first verse is the intriguing one. Because if we read it simply the way I have, and the Rashbam learns it like that, Isha ki Tazria, if a woman conceives, v'yoldon, she has a child, then, if it's a zachar, if it's a male child, these are the laws. If it's a female child further on in the parasha, then these are the laws. And that's how it's taken. But there's another way of understanding it if we link it to the previous parasha, as the Baal HaTurim does and others. The previous parasha we said was v'hiskadishtem, you shall be holy. And then we're told about the woman conceiving. Says the Baal HaTurim, ki shetzorich l'kadesh atzmo b'shas tashmish. That means that there's got to be intention of kedusha at the time of conception. Now we're talking about very high levels. We'll come down to earth again. But let's meanwhile understand it at very high levels. That ideally there should be thoughts of great sanctity at the time of conception. Now, if you learn it that way, then the language actually becomes quite interesting. Then it could learn. We could read it as follows. Isha. How does the English translate it? How does the article translate that? Isha ki Tazria v'yolda zocha. What does it say? Sorry.
When she conceives
and gives birth. Is that what it says?
Yeah.
And gives birth to a male. Now, Tazria could also be the second person singular instead of third person feminine. Could be second person masculine. So how would it read then? Isha, a wife, ki Tazria, if you, the Bnei Yisrael, the men that I'm giving this mitzvah to, if you impregnate her, v'yolda zocha, you're active, there's something active going on, and what we're talking about is not the physical activity. That you don't need a Torah to tell us how to do that. That's not what it's about. But it's also what's going on in terms of spiritual impregnation. Because there's a fascinating concept in halakha, in Kabbalah. When the child is conceived, we understand all the physiology as best as we're able to understand it. We understand what happens. Two cells get together and they start dividing, and magically a baby starts forming. All very wonderful and miraculous. But what about the neshama? Where does that get made? Where does that fit in? When does it fit in? Explains Or HaChaim, that's created by the act of intimacy too. That's when the neshama is created. And while you might be able to create a healthy child, just any old way, what's going on in your mind is going to impact the neshama of this child. And the Aruch Chaim goes further and says, even when there's no conception, when men and women are being intimate together and there isn't, cannot be conception or isn't conception, neshamas are still being made. It's still possible to create a neshama. That's an unbelievable concept. He goes further and he says, in fact, when it says about Abraham and Sarah, Hanefesh asher asu b'charan, the souls they created in Haran. And the Chazal asks, how many souls did they create? Yaakov, Ishmael. Who else? Where? And that wasn't even in Haran. When did they create souls in Haran? Says the Aruch Chaim, every time they were intimate, they created a soul. Difficult for us to understand what that means and what happened to those souls and where did they go and who knows. Maybe some of them became converts later on. Who knows what that's all about? But it's the power. I don't want to go into the Kabbalistic meaning of it. I want to just go into the understanding of the power of the act of the spiritual power. What's happening when this is taking place? It's awesome enough to think about what's happening physically. But to think that a couple is creating an neshama at that moment? A soul is being created? And the body is created by two physical bodies coming together. But a neshama is created by two minds coming together. By two hearts coming together. That's what determines the neshama. So then how would it read? Then we might say, Isha ki tazria. So if you now are active in causing the conception in your wife. Now this is not just you have a sexual relationship and then the wife has a baby. No. Your mind, you need to realize what you're doing. You're getting together and together you're creating a child who has a nefesh. And that nefesh is being created in this moment. Ki tazria, you're causing it. Then v'yolda, she will give birth, and the Aruch Chaim says, maybe not to a child, maybe just to a nefesh, and the child will come later somewhere else. Who knows how that works? But v'yolda zocher, if you look at the gematria of zocher, the Baal HaTurim points out, how much is the gematria of zocher? Reish is 200, and Chof is 20, and Zayin is 7. That's 227. What is the gematria of Barocha? Also 227. That doesn't mean a son is a Barocha and a girl isn't, a daughter isn't. It just means that's another level of understanding this verse. That if you have relations in this way, the Yolda Barocha, then the outcome of that will be Barocha. And if it's not in that way, the outcome will not necessarily be bracha. Says the Aruch Chaim, all the effort we put into raising children, put the effort in at the time of conception. After that, it's too late. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that you don't have to raise children, take care of them and educate. Of course you have to do that. But most of it is already programmed. Just as the DNA is established then, so the spiritual DNA is also established then. Now, you can optimize it. You can develop it. You can make sure that that the potential is actualized. And if you don't raise the child well, then the potential isn't actualized. But you can't give the child potential it doesn't have. So if you figure out how much do we spend raising a child nowadays? When last I did the calculation, it was $1 million, but it's probably a lot more now. I hope you did the calculation. It's $1 million per child. Don't ask me where parents get it from. That's one of the miracles that no accountant has been able to explain to me. But when I go through it with them, they acknowledge it's $1 million a child. Take about 20 years of the child's development, school fees, everything that goes into it. It's $1 million. Where does that come from? And we're willing to invest $1 million into the child. But it would be so much easier if the child started off with the right spiritual DNA. That's the time to really invest. In that one moment, we think investment means years and years of work and toil and providing for and working for and paying tuition for. Yes. But sometimes investment is just an insightful moment, noticing an opportunity. And everything else flows from that. And the opportunity is at the moment of conception. And again, I'm not giving you this year because of the importance just of the conception side of it. What we need to understand is that works in everything we conceive of. If you put the right thought in the moment of conception, everything else is easy. The problem is we conceive out of ego and spend the rest of the time trying to salvage the mess. Because when we conceive out of ego, the result is destructive. We've got to learn how to conceive differently. But let's go a step further before we even go there. There's another way of learning the pasuk. So Isha ki tazriya, now we can learn the pasuk with a feminine way. What happens if the woman is tazriya? So she's the subject of the sentence. A woman conceives. The yolda, in other words, she is active in this process too. She's not passive. She also has her thoughts and her understandings. No, these things we take lightly, or sometimes we take lightly, but if you think, again, Yom HaShoah today, you think of the fact that we've had to repopulate our nation in a relatively short period of time, and to try and repopulate it with the quality we lost, not just with the quantity we lost. The act of marriage and having children takes on a whole new meaning. And if a husband and wife understand that the future of the Jewish people is in their hands, the kind of children they have, the way they raise their children, the number of children they have, the future of the Jewish people is in their hands. And she understands that as much as he does, and they come together in that understanding. Isha ki tazriya, if she's active in the spiritual process of conception, let aside the physical process, if she's active in the physical process, the yoldo. Now I'm going to show you something very interesting. Look at the verse and look at the trop. And tell me how you would punctuate the sentence if you were writing the Torah. Where would you put the comma, assuming you put a comma in that phrase? Dabar b'nei Yisrael emor. Say to the Jewish people, saying, let's say there's a colon after that. Isho ki tazriya v'yoldo zocho. That phrase, if I said to you, put a comma in it, where would the comma go? Isho ki tazriya, right. Isho ki tazriya v'yolda zocha. But if you look at the trop, is that where the comma is? Now it's very easy to tell the commas and the punctuation from the trop because it's very visual. If you look at the trop under the yolda, it's a tipcha, it's called. It's like a little bracket. It's like a parenthesis, a closing bracket. Can you see that? Which means pause. So let's read it the way the trop is put. Isho ki tazriya v'yolda. If a woman conceives, she will give birth, and she will give birth, zochar. Who's the zochar? She is. That's gender equality. When she plays the same part in conception as he does. Now, of course, you might think the woman plays a much bigger part in conception. Yes, physically. But spiritually, this is a joint effort. Isho ki tazriya, if she is active in the process of spiritual conception, the yolda, and that comes to fruition, to the birth of a child, zocho, she's equal to the male in every way. Whole discussion about gender equality. You want to be equal? Make yourselves equal. I'm not just talking to women. Men too. You want to achieve gender equality, work together. Make equal contributions. Not just separate contributions, equal contributions. And then there's gender equality. And the same applies in the home, in the most intimate space of the home. That both are meant to be equally active in that activity. So that zocho meaning not that she's the male and he's the female. No, zocho, they're equal. And again, brocha, they're equal in a way of creation. So that's the avoda part. That's how in the moment of conception one can be involved in avoda, in serving God. Building the Jewish people, creating life. Creating a new nefesh, a new neshama. What more avoda is there than that? What better service of God is there than creating souls? You've got to be like God, be holy because I am holy. What does God do? He creates. So what greater moment is there to emulate God than the moment of conception? And who's busy emulating God? Not just him. They're both emulating God. In exactly the same way, both contributing in exactly the same way. But there's another piece to it as well. We can read the pasuk in a third way. So the one way we read the verse is, Isho ki isho, a woman, a wife, ki tazriya, if you the man initiate her conception, v'yolda zocho, she has a male. The other way to learn it is, Isho ki tazriya, if she is active in that process, then she is a zocho, she is equal to a male in every way. And the third way is the word Tazria might mean something very different. And I'll prove to you that it means something very different from the Gemara. Can't see it in the Chumash, but we can see it in the Gemara. The Gemara gives the recipe for having sons. You want a boy? There's a way to do it. It's not foolproof. At the end of the day, God makes these decisions, but it certainly can influence the odds. Fortunately, I only learned about this Gemara after I had four wonderful daughters. But that's what it does. It changes the odds. And you'll see from what the Gemara says that the word Tazria means something else and changes the whole meaning of what we've been talking about. The Gemara says, Isho ki Tazria, if a woman climaxes first, v'yolda zocha, she'll have a son. And the Gemara still goes further and says, and if that's because if a man can restrain himself and discipline himself and focus on her and on her pleasure, the outcome of that is bracha, and the outcome of that is a son. If he's in a rush to satisfy his own ego needs, then a daughter is the result of that. And there are good reasons why that is, because then it's more the woman, it's basically his efforts. And there's a lot in Kabbalah about that relationship and what the daughter gets from him. It's not anything negative about the daughter, it's just a fact. And the Gemara goes further and says, and if a man finds that difficult, then they should have relations twice, so that she can be sufficiently aroused to be able to have a climax before conception, so that there can be a zocher, if that's what you want. And the Gemara is quite open about that. But now the word Tazria means orgasm. That's what it means. So now look at this again. Straight after Vihiskadishtim, do you see now why I find this linkage so fascinating? And when I said that the opening of the parasha is not about bris milah, and it's not about birth, it's about conception, and it's in fact about sexuality. So now how does it work? Isho ki Tazria then. If a man can ensure and help and make sure that his focus is on her pleasure, not his, then v'yol dozocha, that's losing yourself in gemilus chasodim. That's losing yourself through being involved in somebody else. You can only lose yourself. It's like, you know, you can only displace the water in a container if you put something else into it. You've got to fill it with air, and then the water goes. You can displace darkness with light. You can displace ego with love. And it's either love of the Torah or an idea, or it's love of another person, or it's love of Avodas Hashem. You've got to be involved in something else. You can't just isolate yourself and get rid of ego. And so now we see that there's a place for Gemilus Chasodim, that in that relationship you can strip yourself of ego. And you know what happens when you strip yourself of ego? You're in Kedusha. It doesn't need any more effort than that. Kedusha is not about, you know, lights and all sorts of Kabbalistic things. That's not what sanctity is. Kedusha is that you're in sanctity when you're out of ego. When you're out of self, you're in sanctity. That's all it is. And then you can do what you want with that. You can be on God's wavelength when you're out of self. The Gemara says an arrogant person and God can't exist in the same building. They're not on the same wavelength. They interfere with each other. Arrogance, ego drives godliness out. And lack of ego, if you can lose ego, you pull godliness in, you attract godliness. And the way to attract that godliness and to remove ego is to become dedicated to something bigger than yourself or someone other than yourself. And that's what Isho ki Tazria means. While you're busy creating a life, focus on the other person, not on yourself. Because the life you will create when you've been focusing on the other person is going to be a much higher form of life than if the life was created just as a result of you satisfying your own ego needs. That's what's in this posuk. So what has all this got to do with us? Well, I guess it's got a lot to do with us, but beyond that. So firstly, in all areas of initiation, we often start things. We start an idea, we start a practice, we start a habit, we start a business, we start studying something. We're always starting things. And you know that most of the things we start, we don't get very far with. And that's because we haven't gone through the clear process of conception. Why are we starting it? Is it about us or is it about somebody else? One of the most amazing things of business, and I might have mentioned this to you before, is that business is, and that's why the world was designed by God in such a way that we have to do business with each other. Because in business, you're trained to put other people first. That's the only way you can succeed sustainably. You've got to put a customer first. You've got to put an employee first. You've got to put a shareholder, an investor first. You've got to put a creditor first. Well, everybody else comes before you. If you put yourself first, it's exactly the same as the marital relationship. Put yourself first, you'll feel the results. Put everybody else first, you'll feel the results. And that's how there can be kedusha in business activity. If you're involved in business and you're putting other people all the time, you're thinking about other people, you're able to get out of ego. Business does not have to be an egoistic activity. Business can be an incredibly ego-free activity, just as all the other professions can. We understand that when we think of a physician, certainly in the days before physicians became business people, and they were physicians. We understood that their lives were dedicated to others. And we respected that. That was an amazing thing. Business people are no different. And you can have doctors whose lives are dedicated to themselves, and you can have doctors whose lives are dedicated to others. You can have business people whose lives are dedicated to themselves, and business people whose lives are dedicated to others. But I've made a study of sustainably successful business leaders, and it's the ones who put others first who have the most long-term success. Consistently. So in everything we do, there's that idea. There's a beautiful story which you might know of Reb Chaim Volozhiner coming to the Vilna Gaon with the idea. He innovated the idea of the modern yeshiva, which didn't exist then. In those days, people went to a rabbi in a town and sat in the shul and they studied. The idea of institutionalized yeshivas didn't exist. Reb Chaim Volozhiner created it. And he went to the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon said, absolutely no, forget it, drop it. And he went a few years later and he said, I've been thinking about it some more and I really think it's a good idea. And the Vilna Gaon said, drop it. Years later, the Vilna Gaon said, what's happened to your idea about starting a yeshiva? Why have you done nothing about it? And he says, because you told me not to. He says, I told you not to when the driving force was your own ego. That's not true anymore. Now you can start a yeshiva. When we start things for other people, they last. When we start things for ourselves, they're very hard. They take a lot of effort to make succeed, and sometimes they never do. So in things that we initiate, when we talk about conception, I would like you to take the shir far further than the relationship between a man and a woman. It's important in that area. But it goes far beyond that. It'd be the idea of conception. Ezehu chochom is haroyes hanoilad. To notice something has been conceived. And when it's conceived, you've got to put all the effort into the conception because everything else flows from that. And the effort in conception is kedusha. The effort in conception is ego, or is this for something bigger than me or someone other than me? If it's someone other than me, that's something. That's one thing. If it's me, that's ego. So what's it got to do with Yom HaShoah? I have a feeling, an idea that I can't prove, of course, when we deal with the Holocaust and with the rise of the State of Israel, two incredible miracles that took place within a couple of years of each other. Miracles by miracle, I don't mean that they were both good, one was terrible. But miracles mean something supernatural, something that cannot be explained naturally. And the Holocaust cannot be explained naturally. There's no way to explain it. And therefore it's supernatural, it's a miracle. Whatever, for whatever reason. You know, the splitting of the Dead Sea was a miracle for the Egyptians too, not just for us. They died. That wasn't a nice miracle for them. It was a very unpleasant miracle. But it doesn't mean it's not a miracle just because it was unpleasant. Miracle is when nature breaks its boundaries and God takes over in a very open way. And in the Holocaust, we don't begin to understand, but this was God. This wasn't just man. And the emergence of the State of Israel when it did and everything that's happened there since. To me, the conception of the State of Israel was not Theodor Herzl. Because Theodor Herzl was willing to take Uganda. The idea of a Jewish state was Theodor Herzl. But not the idea of Israel as we have it today. He was a part of it and these were intellectual ideas and they were talked about and all of that was an important process. But the idea I want to put out to you, and again, I've got no proof for it at all. It's purely anecdotal, is that the real disruption that changed the world and made it open to a state of Israel was the Holocaust. I can't say that's the reason for it. We don't know what the reason for anything is. Certainly not anything as big as that. But it's possible that without that, the world would never have allowed a state of Israel. In which case, it's possible that the state of Israel as we know today is a mokum Torah, a place where Torah is being studied, not just a homeland for the Jewish people, but a place where Torah is being studied in vast numbers. When you think how little Torah was being studied after the war, when I went to yeshiva, I almost knew every yeshiva bocher. There were only four or five yeshivas. And in the big yeshivas, there were 400 in Ponovich, and there were 400 in Hebron, and there were 400 in Mir. In the rest of the yeshivas, there were 100 boys maximum. And you could count the yeshivas on one or two hands. You went away for a Shabbos to a couple of yeshivas, and you met every yeshiva bocher. Today, you're talking about tens of thousands and more. The numbers of people who are learning Daf Yomi, and yes, the quality of learning has a lot to still be wanted, and all sorts of complaints we can make and have, but it's very miraculous that in such a short time this has happened. It's completely miraculous. And that Israel as it is today might have been conceived in the ashes of the Holocaust more than anywhere else. Now, if that's so, if we say that just as when a man and woman are having relationships, two things are happening. A physical formation is taking place, and a spiritual formation is taking place. The physical formation is biochemical. The spiritual formation comes from intention. What is the intention at the moment of conception? When you start a business, there's a physical structure. That comes from the effort of putting things together, the components of a business. But there's also a soul to a business. The soul comes from your intention. Why are you doing it? What's it for? What is the service you're going to provide to mankind? That gives a business its soul, the why question. And so if we look at the Holocaust and we say that there were some physical things that happened then, and momentous physical things, but what was the spiritual conception taking place at that moment? So now think of what the angels in Shemayim must have been feeling, doing, watching Jews go to their death, singing Ani Ma'amin. That is superhuman. That's not human. No animal can do that. When I start off by saying what people did, what the martyrs did, no other organism can do. You can't have your survival threatened and be singing, I believe in the future. That doesn't happen. Ani Ma'amin, Mashiach, visions of the future. Where does that happen when your very physical survival is being threatened, and not just your own physical survival? Those people believed there was nothing left. They were shocked after the war to find there were still people around. They thought everybody was gone. And still to sing Ani Ma'amin? For Rabbi Chonan Wasserman, you know, there was a rabbi, Reb Simcha Wasserman, in Los Angeles for many years. We're talking about his father. Chonan Wasserman is taken with his community to be slaughtered, to be shot at their gravesides. And he puts on his Shabbos suit before he goes. He tells the Nazis who've come to fetch him, hold on a second. He puts on his Shabbos suit, his beautiful long coat, his golden pocket watch, his Shabbos hat. And he walks out into the street, standing tall. Why? Because he's going to do the most important mitzvah a Jew can do. That's why. And he's dressed to do that mitzvah. It's a mitzvah we all pray we'll never have to do. But if, God forbid, we're in that situation, there's no mitzvah greater. And he prepares himself to do a mitzvah. And he goes and he's standing at the graveside, and the Germans are standing around, the Nazis with their rifles ready, lining everybody up in front of the trench. And he looks at them in the eye, the commander, and he says, not yet. I have something to do before you go ahead. And they stand back. And he teaches his community how to die al Kiddush Hashem. He goes through the halachas and the Rambam and explains to them why their thought is going to be the most important part of what's about to happen. The physical part of you can't control. It's going to happen. Conception's going to happen. Who knows where it's going to lead to? But you can control your mind. As you're being killed, you could get angry at God, or you could feel animamin. You could say, I don't understand, but hatsur tamim pa'olo. Don't understand God, but I accept God. And the quality of your thought is going to determine the future of the Jewish people. That's what he told them. The quality of the thought at the moment of conception. Did he know what child was going to emerge? No. That was not able to be controlled. But he did know whatever was going to emerge was going to be impacted by the thoughts taking place at the moment of conception. And imagine what God and his angels were doing at that moment. Watching Jews giving their lives with that level of dignity, that level of pride. Yeah, they could have thrown a few stones at the Nazis and be killed before they had a chance to say Shema Yisrael. They could have tried to steal a gun and kill a Nazi or two. What difference was it going to make? No difference. Even the holding out in the Warsaw Ghetto, as courageous as that was, what difference does it make in the end? No difference. But the difference to the future of the Jewish people that might have been impacted by the thoughts of the martyrs, we can't begin to understand. Because what we see in Parshas Tazria is that the thought at the moment of conception determines the quality of outcome. And looking back, in the ashes and destruction of the Holocaust, there was the conception of a very different future for the Jewish people. The future that came after the Second World War, that we're in the middle of now, took us into a space that we've never been before as a nation. Never, ever. Completely new and different. Good and bad, we've done all sorts of things with it. But we're living in ways that as a nation we've never been able to live before. And all of that might have been conceived in those moments that those leaders decided, instead of resisting, to focus on Avodas Hashem. Get rid of the ego. Resisting is ego, not in a negative sense, it's self-defense. Self-defense is ego. Self-defense is survival. Self-defense is, I'm going to lose my life, I'm insecure, what can I do to keep it? But this is heroics. To sing an imami, to say Shema Yisrael, to teach the community the laws of Kiddush Hashem at those moments, that's heroics. That's not survival. So that's what we, some of the things that we're able to learn from this very difficult first posuk, how the moment of conception is so important. We all suffer from insecurity. We can deal with our insecurity with love or with fear. Love we can deal with in three different ways. We can lose ourselves in our love for Torah, for ideas. We can lose ourselves in our love for service of God, and we can lose ourselves for love for another human being. Any of those methods bring kedusha with it. Any of those methods bring sanctity with it. And when we're able to lose ourselves and bring in the sanctity, if it's at the moment of conception, we can bring sanctity into the moments of conception. Who knows how that impacts not only the future of our lives, but the future of the Jewish people, and even the future of humanity. So thank you for making the effort to be here tonight. I know it wasn't easy, and it wasn't an easy thing. And Chazan Nati Barani.